Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Thursday afternoon here in Southern California, and a nice sunny one. Glad that we're with you wherever you are. Maybe it's evening where you are. Maybe you're on the other side of the dateline and it's morning and good morning.
It's always 5 o'clock in the morning somewhere.
Somewhere. That's right. It's always 5 o'clock somewhere. We're going to Jacksonville, Florida now.
Oh, why? It's going to be 5 o'clock here in an hour.
Yes, it will. Yeah. You are, Jimmy, look at that. You've done so well reading the clock. The digital clock, though, it doesn't have a top of the hour and the bottom of the hour.
No.
That always cracks me up that the young people don't know what the bottom of the hour is or the top of the hour.
It's secret knowledge reserved for only mature people.
Yes, that's right. What does top of the morning to you mean? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, humans have an orientation toward, because we're vertical. I mean, we walk upright.
Yeah.
And our main sensory organ, you know, area is our head, which is at our top. So we have a natural, because of our physical build, we have a natural orientation towards regarding the top of something as the important
better
part.
Oh.
And as the better part. So that's like why it's polite manners to look at someone's face, not their feet.
Uh-huh.
And
whenever someone's looking at my feet and talking to me, I'm always like, I'm up here. My
exactly.
face is up here.
Yeah.
And that's what I do.
And so top of the morning means like the best of the morning to you. Because we associate the head of something, the top of something, with the best of it. And so did the Israelites. Although they had more, even with quadrupeds, because they were an agrarian society, God promises them that if they obey, they will be the head of nations rather than the tail.
Ah, yes, which is better.
But still, you've got that that bilateral symmetry of the life form going there.
Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a whole bunch of things, including—
If we were radiates, it would be completely different.
What's a radiate?
A radiate is like
a starfish or something?
Yeah, starfish are an example of radiates. They uh-huh. have a radial symmetry rather than a bilateral symmetry. So instead, they don't have like a left and a right. They have multiple sides that radiate out from a common point.
I gotcha. I'm glad we're not radiates. I like being a, what are we called now?
We're bilateral.
Yeah, I like that better than being a radiate.
Bilateral bipeds.
I think we better go to the phones. Paul in Jacksonville, Florida, watching on YouTube Live. You are next, Paul. Thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question, please, for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, thanks for taking my call again. I was talking with some fellow Catholics, and we were discussing about the final hour of our death choice, you know, the last second of our life where we have to lock in our acceptance or rejection of God,
mm-hmm.
and how we're supposed to pray for those people that are destined for the bad place.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about a story of somebody that was committing suicide, jumped off the building, and halfway down, you know, decided to repent and choose God, and you know, that's the kind of thing that we saw. But anyway, we were talking about those people like Judas. If he, you know, after he put the noose around his neck and jumped, did he, you know, we pray that he did perfect contrition and was, you know, saved and didn't end up in hell. I guess the thing is, when we get to that last second choice, and I'm trying to think of the opposite.
Oh, so could someone choose wrong even after they had chosen right?
Yeah, if you have if you've led a generally righteous life, and you're not in the state of mortal sin or anything, but you, because of, say, you're old and you lack some mental capacity and you just choose poorly. Not to borrow from.
Could you blow it?
Okay, so
could you
I
blow
think I've
right
got the
end?
Sense of the question. Let me see if I can address it. The only thing that determines your fate is, are you in a state of grace or not at the time of your death? If you have been in a state of grace and you retain the use of your faculties including the full use of your free will, then it is hypothetically possible to commit a mortal sin immediately before death. And if you do that, you know, God still has ways of reaching you with his grace. It's still possible to repent in the last moments of life. There's a saying that I've heard used, between the bootstrap and the ground, pardon sought is pardon found.
Yeah.
And the idea there is, you're sitting on a horse and you're being hung from a tree and they scare the horse so your feet come out of the bootstraps and you fall. Well, if you seek God's pardon between the moment you come out of the bootstraps and the moment you hit the bottom of the rope, you'll receive God's pardon. At least that's a poetic way of putting it. But it expresses the truth that God does have ways of reaching you even at the last minute. Now, what if you don't? What if you don't repent? Well, then you've made a free and voluntary choice not to be with God for all eternity, and he will honor that. And so you would not go to heaven in that case. But back up another step, Paul, you alluded to what if you have some diminished capacity, you know, perhaps due to old age or perhaps due to something else. A person who is in a state of diminished capacity, assuming it's diminished enough, does not have the sufficient use of free will to be able to commit a mortal sin. And so if someone is suffering from dementia does not have the ability to commit a mortal sin, then they will simply remain in the state of grace they were in when last they did have the full use of free will. It's like, essentially, I mean, sometimes people will talk about old age or certain types of old age as a second childhood. And just like there's a time in children's lives before they can commit mortal sin, for people who return to a childlike state, you know, due to dementia or whatever, they, there is a point after which they're incapable of mortal sin. So even if you have a toddler who does something that gravely injures another person, the toddler has not mortally sinned. In the same way, if you had a demented person, whether they're old or not, if you had a demented person who gravely harms another person, they haven't committed a mortal sin. In order for a mortal sin to be committed, the three conditions always have to be fulfilled together. There has to be grave matter, full knowledge of the moral character of the act, and deliberate consent to it anyway. And if someone is suffering from diminished capacity, it means they either don't have full knowledge of what's going on or they don't fully consent to it. And so on either of those grounds, even if someone chose poorly, to use your words, Paul, if they lacked the capacity to fully use their free will, then God knows that, and he's not going to hold them fully accountable for it.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate that call. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We better take a quick break, and then we'll be right back to continue with questions for Jimmy on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connection's set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
When I was outside of the church, there was always an unsettled feeling. There was always a feeling of something missing and something not complete. The deal clincher is we found our way to our parish, and we met just an incredible pastor. We learned things that we had never been taught. Wouldn't be the person that I am without the church and without the sacraments, particularly the Eucharist. I can't live without it.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Guess what? Well, first of all, welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Shop.catholic.com has digital video. We haven't had that before. That's right. We've rolled out the first batch of digital videos you can watch in the comfort of your own home. And better yet, the price is less than a cup of coffee. But that, cup of coffee, that could be anywhere from like $3 to $12 nowadays. I don't know. But it's less than that. Visit shop.catholic.com. Check out our new digital video category. That's exciting. That's a great way to communicate. I'm glad we have that. Let's go now to Mateo in Ontario, Canada. Mateo, are you there with us?
Yes, I am. Hey, guys.
Hi.
So my question, I'm a first-time caller, and my question is about the Church of England. So mm-hmm. I have a private devotion to King Henry the VII, King Henry the VIII's dad, and I'm just wondering about how come King Henry the VIII drastically changed from his father, where his father was more pious and more devoted, and then how come the church then went further into chaos when Henry the VIII and his, like, his thought process just quickly changed when the year 1536 came and he wanted his annulment. And I'm also wondering, what will it take for the church to unify with from England to Rome?
Okay.
So it sounds like you already have a pretty good knowledge of Reformation-era British history. I'm not sure how much I can add. Obviously, the motivating factor, that historians, both Catholic and Protestant, acknowledge for Henry VIII's split with the church was his desire for an heir. He wanted an heir. He wanted a male heir to pass his kingdom on to. He was having trouble conceiving one. He went through a series of wives. He petitioned the Pope for an annulment so that he could separate from his current wife and marry another in the hopes of obtaining an heir. The Pope did not grant his request, and so he ended up saying, okay, well, I'm now going to be the head of the Church of England, and we're going to separate from communion with Rome. And then that kind of set into motion a cascade of events that led to a lot of religious diversity in England and within the Church of England, and things went back and forth. You had a variety of different ideologies or viewpoints emerging within English religious life, including Puritanism and Quakers and other nonconformists. And you had persecution of Catholics. You had the political fortunes change as you had individuals like Oliver Cromwell coming into power, or some of the later Catholic kings, Mary Tudor, for example, and there was a lot of chaos. Or I may have my Mary wrong in that case, but there was a lot of chaos, and I'm not sure how much in a brief space I can add to that. In terms of what would happen or what would need to happen for reunification, well, the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church would need to come to a meeting of minds on all of the substantive doctrinal issues. There could be variations in how there could be various accommodations made for various practices that have emerged in the Anglican Communion since the time of the separation. But on matters of doctrine, there would need to be agreement. And currently, as a result of the ecumenical movement, we're closer in some ways than we were, but we're also farther apart in some ways than we were. A key move that began in the Anglican Communion that was widely seen as a harm to the effort to reunite was the ordination of women, because that's now widely practiced in the Anglican Communion. Not everywhere, but it is widely practiced. And there was an urgent appeal before the first authorized women's ordination started occurring in the Anglican Church, from the Catholic Church, saying, are you sure you want to do this? Because this is going to make it harder, not easier, for us to get back together. And the Anglican Communion went ahead and started doing it anyway. So that's something that is a barrier that didn't used to be there. On the other hand, there has been dialogue that has helped resolve certain other tensions. So it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of where things are. I personally don't see a total reunification with the Anglican Church anytime in my lifetime. It would, I think, be at least a century or two, if it ever happens, before that could be possible. It could be many centuries. But I do see hope in reunifications on a smaller scale. And I would point in particular to the various Anglican ordinariates that now exist. Pope Benedict XVI made provisions for receiving Anglicans, including Anglican clergy, into the Catholic Church in a broader way than had been previously the case. There had already been some Anglican use parishes here and there, but with Pope Benedict's issuing a motu proprio on the subject and setting up of canonical structures to receive them, like the ordinariate for Anglicans we have here in the United States. There's another one in Britain. There's one in Australia. It's now possible for those Anglicans and Episcopalians who do fully share the church's faith to come back into the church in a way that allows them to retain their own distinctives. And so, for example, they have variations in the liturgy that I alluded earlier to the possibility of allowing accommodations for various legitimate practices that have developed in Anglicanism, and that's an example of that. You know, they're allowed to use certain variations that are broadly referred to as the Anglican use of the liturgy. So it seems to me that for the foreseeable future, that's the most likely and logical path for reunification occurring on smaller scales. I don't see a larger reunification anytime soon, though.
Okay, Mateo?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Kathy in Oregon, listening on Modern Day Catholic Radio. Kathy, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about fetal cells and fetal cell lines used by the medical community and pharmaceutical companies and the soul. So I'm thinking about the definition of death as the soul separates from the body, and that causes death. And these fetal cells are taken from aborted babies that they have to be living.
Not always. There are some lines that have been, and in some the
so
status is ambiguous.
So how do they reanimate a line if the cells have died and started to decay?
They don't. The once the cells are dead, they're dead. So these are living cells.
So they take living cells from an organ. Mm-hmm. So what's animating those cells if it's not the soul?
So the church does not have a teaching on this point, but the standard theological view would be that every living thing has a soul. And so if you were to take cells from a living human being, it doesn't have to be an unborn child. It can be an adult. And you remove them from the unity of the overall body, presumably there is an ongoing spiritual reality that they have that keeps them alive. And this is an area that is really speculative because, as I said, the church doesn't have a definite teaching on this, but the theological opinion would be that any life form has a soul of some kind. It's not in the case of non-humans, it's not a rational soul, and the general opinion is that non-rational souls don't survive death. But in the case of a part of an organism that still retains its own life once separated from the body, that's a little more iffy. Now, one of the first things, and this is another thing I've been reading about within the last 24 hours, Cy.
Wow.
But according to the thought of some medieval theologians, including Blessed John Duns Scotus, it's possible for a physical form, for a physical body to have more than one form. And in the case that he talked about, he would say, okay, the primary form of the human body is the soul. But when the soul departs and you have a dead body, there's still a form there that keeps it together for a while until the processes of disintegration take over. And that he referred to as I don't want to say the Latin term because I'll mess it up because it's too new to me. But he would say there's this additional kind of form and that a physical body could have multiple forms. So what you could propose is that, based on this line of thinking, is that in addition to the rational soul, which is the primary form of the body that keeps it alive, there may be lesser forms that also could keep a part of the body alive. whether it's an organ or, you know, a cell or things like that. But the key thing is they would not be rational souls. So as a result, they do not have human rights. They are not human beings. If that were not the case, blood transfusions would not be possible. Because our blood contains all kinds of living cells. If Cy Kellett needed a blood transfusion and I'm the only person available to give it to him, you know, maybe after Cy has been the victim of one of Trent's insidious plots, then in order to save Cy's life, I'll intervene and give him a blood transfusion. But as part of that, I'm giving him living cells from my own bloodstream, including white blood cells and natural killer cells and things like that. Those cells have something that's keeping them alive, some kind of spiritual reality, which you could propose maybe on the lines of Duns Scotus as a kind of lesser form that does not amount to a rational soul. But my natural killer cells and my white blood cells are not human beings. They do not have human rights. And if you found a way to develop a cell line out of my white blood cells or out of my natural killer cells so you could make more of them in case Cy needs them in the future, that line would continue to live, but it would not have a rational soul. It would not be a human being, and consequently, we shouldn't think of it as if that cell line were a human being because it's not.
Kathy, I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you very, very much for the call. I always enjoy it when Jimmy...
saves you from Trent's plots?
No, I was going to say pretends to be a human being and not an android. I think that that's...
okay.
I think that's
none taken.
Very good very data. Data can't give a trans... What's it called? Transfusion.
Prick us and do we not leak?
Exactly. Right. Do you dream of electric sheep?
That's between me and my hairdresser.
Okay, Nate in Dallas, Texas, watching on YouTube Live. You're next. Go ahead, Nate.
Hey, gentlemen. Good afternoon. Hi, Cy. Hi, Ricky. Hi, Jimmy. Sorry about that. I just talked to my brother online.
No problem. Good to talk with you, Nate.
Good to talk to y'all. I have a question about suicide. I know that it is a mortal sin. I know that... Jimmy just spoke about between the saddle and the ground. I think that was the term, but I'd like to tie that in as well.
Sure.
If you commit suicide, do you still, you know, get that one last chance? But my original question is, say that there's a hypothetical innocent person. They're about to be killed by an evil person, and a priest steps in and offers his life instead. Is that suicide? Do they go to heaven? Does it count? Because I know that Jesus didn't commit suicide, even though he gave his life willingly. Mm-hmm. So does it matter, like, what the intent is? Like, if the priest was, you know, trying to escape something, like, they wanted to die anyway, they were trying to escape being found out for something, does that count as suicide? Or does that have to be pure intention, stuff like that? So all of that, if you would, please.
Okay. So I'll probably need to finish this on the other side of the break. Now, the most relevant case to this that I can think of off the top of my head that actually occurred was that of St. Maximilian Kolbe. During the Second World War, Maximilian Kolbe, who was a priest, was in one of the Nazi death camps, and he did volunteer to have his life taken in place of a layman, and they then did take his life. And people have looked at that and said, huh, was this suicide or not?
Yeah.
And the church has now declared him a saint, and he's even considered a martyr. But I would say, and it's been a while since I've thought through the details of this, but to sketch a general answer, let me talk about what's known as the law of double effect. The law of double effect is a moral principle that allows you to foresee that an evil will occur as a side effect of an action that you take, and it's legitimate to, so you can tolerate this evil. It's legitimate to undertake this course of action as long as the evil that is suffered is neither a means to an end, nor is it a good in and of, nor is it the end itself. It's not what you're trying to achieve. And so a classic example of this would, again, be a wartime example. Let's say you're in a foxhole. This would put us in World War I. and a grenade gets tossed into your foxhole, can you jump on the grenade foreseeing that you're likely to die as a result? But you will save all of the other people in the foxhole. The standard moral analysis would say, yes, you can jump on the grenade because the law of double effect applies. In this case, you are not seeking death as an end and of itself. You know,
right.
If you could jump on the grenade and survive,
you would.
You would welcome that. Similarly, if you could, if it's not a means, your death is not a means to an end. What is doing the work here in saving the other people is the fact your body is in the way, not that you're dying.
Yeah.
So your death also is not a means toward an end. But there's more to say, and we'll say it in just a few moments.
Hang on, Nate. We'll be right back. More Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is one of the most courageous leaders in the church, known for his outspoken support of unborn life, Orthodox faith and morals, and reforming Catholic institutions. In his groundbreaking new book, Light and Leaven, he offers a forthright perspective on the state of the church today and calls on the lay faithful to meet its challenges boldly. Touching on topics including parish renewal, the centrality of the Eucharist, the need for prayer and silence in a noisy and distracted age, and the battle between good and evil in the church and world, Bishop Strickland's wise insights and evident love for souls will inspire and edify you. To order your copy of Light and Leaven, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Matt Swaim here. Join us tomorrow for the Sunrise Morning Show as we celebrate the solemnity of the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus with Father Thomas Daly, the author of Behold This Heart. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
You're the best, Darren. Groovy music twice.
Darren is double groovy.
He's double groovy. Thanks, double groovy, Darren. Look at that. Nathaniel Thomas dancing in there.
Sit dancing, that's what that's called.
Sit dancing is when you're dancing, sit in a chair? Yeah. Nice sit dancing.
There are actually choreographed sit dances.
Really?
Yeah. And callers will sometimes use them, for example, if you're doing a gig in an old folks' home. And you want to let everybody participate, even the ones who don't have the same mobility that they used to.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's good. We were talking to Nate in Dallas.
Right. So according to the law of double effect, you would be able to jump on a grenade in a foxhole because you're not trying to die. If you could survive, you would. You would welcome that. So death is not your end. It's not your goal.
Yeah.
Similarly, your death, if it occurs, is not a means to an end of saving these other people. The means is putting your body in the way of an explosion.
Uh-huh.
If you happen to die as a result of that, well, it wasn't the fact that you died that led to them being saved. It was the fact you put your body in the way that let them be saved. And so in that case, your death, which you foresee is likely to happen, is merely a side effect of this chain of events. It's not a means or an end. And as long as it's a side effect that you foresee, you can still pursue this line of action as long as there is a sufficient reason, like saving the other people in the foxhole.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if we take this principle, you can apply it to situations like St. Maximilian Kolbe. And you could say, okay, well, in principle, he's trying to save a layman, so and the lives are equal. So you've got a proportionate goal you're trying to achieve. It doesn't have to be a greater goal than what you're losing. It just has to be equal or greater. So if you're saving someone else's life, that's equal to your own life.
Fine. Yeah, so got it. Right.
That hurdle is cleared. You're not seeking death on your own. You're not suicidal. You don't want to die here. You're just allowing the Nazis to kill you in this other guy's place. And you can argue it's not your death that is actually and this is where it gets a little trickier. But you can argue that your death also is not a means because you might survive.
Yeah.
You know, right. They might shoot you and then they might repent and you might actually pull through this. It's the fact you're making this offer that, and you're throwing your body in the way that allows this guy to survive. It's not the fact you died that allowed him to survive.
Right.
And at least it's arguable that that's the case. So there is a scenario that would allow someone, and it is argued that would allow someone to do this kind of thing. Having said that, it's a tricky situation because your intentionality is important here.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are secretly suicidal and you do have, I just want to die, that's my goal here, and you're committing suicide by Nazi instead of suicide by cop, well, then it would be suicide, and that would be gravely sinful, although, as we've covered, suicide is not automatic loss of salvation because of various reasons. On the other hand, merely having a desire to not suffer anymore, you know, you're in this horrible prison camp, and you're really suffering and you wouldn't mind dying, that as long as it's not your goal, you know, just thinking, hey, it would be nice not to suffer and I'm willing to do this for this guy because it's a good thing to do, but I also wouldn't mind not suffering anymore. Well, that's a mixed motive, but it's not a bad mixed motive.
Right.
But you can see how similar those states of mind are. And so it is a dicey situation. But yes, to answer Nate's question, your intention is important here. There are scenarios where this arguably is a legitimate thing to do, but there are also scenarios where it would not be a legitimate thing to do.
Thanks, Nate. I hope that's helpful. We got a lot of folks on the line. Got to keep moving. Going right back here to San Diego, watching on Facebook Live. Paula here in San Diego. You go ahead, Paula, with your question. Hi, Paula.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you. I go to confession on a regular basis.
Good.
But one of the things that has come to my mind is I'll be thinking and I'll be like, oh my gosh, I did, you know, something, you know, when I was a child. And I completely forgot about it, never confessed. So my question is if you get into a position like that, I try to confess as much as I can, but is it, you know, my concern is not repenting and being stuck in purgatory.
Okay.
And so I'm wondering, you know, I know everybody is a sinner and everybody sins, but what happens if you don't repent?
Okay. In the case of a venial sin, what a venial sin essentially is an attachment. It's a disordered attachment to something that you shouldn't be that attached to, but it's not something that puts a fundamental barrier between you and God. So what happens in the case of a venial sin is God will, via purgatory or whatever, I mean, purgatory is really what we call this process, he will cure you of that disordered attachment. And so that may you may experience some suffering as a result of that, as he kind of puts the you know, your spiritual limbs back into their joints. It, you know, it's kind of like getting physical therapy. You, it may not be entirely comfortable, but he will fix you. And because you're letting him, you have not fundamentally put a barrier between you and him. You just have a disordered attachment that needs to be put back into line. And so there are no eternal consequences for venial sins. There are only temporary consequences as God fixes the problem. On the other hand, if it's an eternal, if it's a mortal sin and you don't repent of it, well, in the case of a mortal sin, you have crushed the spiritual life out of your soul and said, I don't want to be with God. And if you are in that state and you have not repented of it, at least implicitly, then you would not end up going to heaven. Now, we have to distinguish. You'll notice I just mentioned repented explicitly or implicitly. There's a distinction that's there. Anybody may have committed mortal sins earlier in their life that they have forgotten.
Sure.
Especially people who are no longer teenagers. They may have committed individual mortal sins that they have forgotten. Well, God knows you've forgotten that. He doesn't expect you to deal consciously with things you have no conscious memory of. It's sufficient in those cases to say, you know, even if I've forgotten all those things, to just say, oh, God is the greatest good. I want to be with him. And go to confession, and since you don't remember it, you don't have to confess it. God knows your heart. He knows you would confess it if you remembered it and if you knew you needed to. Even if you never remember it, it's okay, because God knows that you, whatever you did in the past, God knows if you consider him your goal, that he's the one you want to be with. God understands that. He knows that. It doesn't matter that you've forgotten. All you have to do in confession is confess those things that you know for a fact were mortal sins that you have not previously confessed. In doubtful cases, if you're not sure it's a mortal sin, well, then you're not obligated to confess it. It might be a good idea to do it unless you're a scrupulous person, in which case the advice is don't, because it'll feed your scrupulosity. Mm-hmm. Also, if you're not sure if you've confessed it before, well, then you aren't sure if you need to confess it.
Yeah.
Because if you have already confessed it and have just forgotten that you confessed it, well, you don't know. Do I need to confess this or not? You're uncertain about that. And again, if you're a person of a robust conscience and it's not going to bug you to reconfess it, well, then fine, go ahead and reconfess it. That's a good thing to do. But if you're a scrupulous person, then the advice is don't confess it unless you're sure you haven't confessed it before, because otherwise it can lead to an endless cycle of repeatedly confessing the same stuff, which is not spiritually healthy for you. So, and where you feel like you're trapped in this cycle of confession.
Does that all make sense to you, Paula?
Yes, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, has got to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
War of words. Conservative senators question the amount of taxpayer money Planned Parenthood received from the Paycheck Protection Program. Investigating abuse cases. Why Pope Francis ordered an apostolic visitation of an archdiocese in Germany. Inner city revitalization. The Archbishop of Baltimore shares new initiatives to serve young people.
EWTN News Nightly with Tracy Sable. Tonight, 9 Eastern on EWTN Television and Radio.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we're having lots of fun. Hey, my book, it's new, so I can't say it's improved, but it's new. It's out. It's A Teacher of Strange Things.
It is improved compared to where it was when you started it.
Well, that's true. There have been considerable improvements, like
editing
words.
And words. yeah.
Words and stuff. A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him, meant to bring the person who believes in Jesus closer to Jesus, but more than anything, to help those who have not fully been introduced to Jesus, maybe to find that invitation. You can get it on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. It's 25% off when you buy it at shop.catholic.com and use the promo code TEACHME at checkout. Let's see where we're going now. We're going, I believe, to Kevin in Kentucky, watching on YouTube Live. Kevin, got a question for Jimmy?
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Kevin.
I'm a big fan of the show, and just for context, I am not Catholic.
Okay. All right. Did you pay the extra $5 or?
I did, yeah.
Okay. Oh. I'm only playing, Kevin. All right. Go ahead.
We'll validate your parking anyway. What can we do?
Currently, I consider myself a methodological naturalist.
Okay.
How would you, Catholics, go about convincing me that naturalism is false? If you do want to talk about minds, mm-hmm. I'd have a follow-up question, but I'll save that.
Okay. Let's start with our definitions, because the term naturalism can mean different things to different people. What do you mean when you say you're a methodological naturalist? I just want to make sure I'm clear.
Yeah, so I don't take axiomatically or dogmatically that the supernatural does not or cannot exist.
Good.
I just claim that I have no way of exploring it, so I'm going to withhold belief until somehow it's demonstrated. So
okay.
I don't dogmatically claim naturalism to be true, but I do reject supernaturalism only because I don't see evidence for it.
Okay. Well, I would respond by pointing to a number of things. One of them is something that we all have access to. We do have access to our minds. And our minds do seem to have properties that are I should clarify, by the way, when you say you're a naturalist, are you also a materialist? Do you think that matter is the fundamental reality?
Yeah. Mostly matter energy.
Yeah, matter energy, same thing. Yeah. Okay, so so we all have an intuitive experience of our own minds, and our minds have qualities that do not seem to be displayed in our physical bodies and in the organ that principally corresponds to and interacts with our mind, which is the brain. If I have an idea, for example, of a racetrack that's a mile long, it's not that in my head there's an oval shape that's a mile long, but I can still have this idea. And that suggests that there are things in the world, like ideas, that are not obviously made of matter and energy. In addition, there are other things, it would seem, our intuitions tell us that there are other things in the world that also are not part of the matter-energy paradigm that natural science studies. These are I hate to use fancy words, but I need to in this case. They're non-empirical. They're things that we believe to exist even though we cannot measure them with the sciences. And examples of those things include moral values. If you believe, Kevin, that it's really wrong to kill Jews just because they're Jews or to torture babies for fun, if you think that's morally wrong to do, then you would believe in moral values and that moral values are real. But moral values are non-empirical. We can't study, you know, just how evil is it to kill a Jewish person just for being Jewish, or how evil is it to subject a baby to this amount of torture? We could do things like measure how much pain they're in, but that doesn't tell us how wrong it is, because wrongness is not a quality that is subject to empirical investigation. And so that would suggest, if you believe that there are moral truths, then and that some things really are right and wrong, then that would suggest there is a non-empirical aspect to reality, and thus that naturalism is not a complete story, that it needs to be supplemented by these other things. I would go further as a Christian and say, well, we actually have evidence of miracles occurring, both historically and in the present. Now, obviously, I'm having to sketch this answer in the most general terms because it's like meant to only be a few minutes long on the radio. But there is a supporting literature about miracles, both covering the philosophical foundations of miracles and how they work and how they are not purely natural events, even though they may incorporate natural elements into them. But the occurrence of miracles, which is documented both historically and in the present day, even though a lot of skeptics have never looked at this literature, there is documentation of these events that also point beyond the purely natural. And then I would say, and there's also the field of parapsychology, which has produced studies that, again, continue to point beyond what we understand to be the operations of matter and energy. So there are a variety of different fronts that of categories of evidence that I would point to. Obviously, you know, I don't have time to teach a course on them right now, but I can potentially recommend some additional stuff for you maybe off the air, Kevin, if you'd like to contact me off the air. And you said you had a follow-up question about minds?
I do, yeah. So I'll add real quick, I actually reject the concept of inherent morality, uh-huh. though I am fine with objective morality. So if we agree that, you know, torture is objectively wrong, then we have an objective, how much torture are you doing? If you're doing more than zero torture, then it's objectively wrong, mm-hmm. even if it's not inherently wrong. But my question about minds is the emergent theory. So let me first say I'm not a biologist. Mm-hmm. I'm quite dumb in the area of biology. But the emergent theory of minds strikes me as at least plausible as a non-biologist. Mm-hmm. And certainly plausible is far more likely to me than anything supernatural, since I don't have any other supernatural explanations for anything at all. So mm-hmm. even a only somewhat plausible naturalistic explanation almost must be more plausible than any supernatural hypothesis.
So let me ask you a question then. Have you read any books by Christian philosophers on philosophy of mind, or have you read any books on near-death on the scientific investigation of near-death experiences or of other paranormal phenomena? Or is that a literature that you haven't had a chance to dig into at this point?
I've read a couple studies on near-death experiences around the globe, and I'll admit to not reading too many books from Christian authors, but mm-hmm. I do try to listen to people like Fazer uh-huh. and William Lane Craig and Trent Horn and somebody named Jimmy Akin, if you know him.
Oh, that guy.
Mm-hmm. more podcasts than books, if I'm being honest.
Sure. Well, I have several that I'm thinking of from the different categories I just mentioned. And if you contact me, my email address is out there on the web, and I'm on Twitter. And if you contact me privately, I'll see what I can do about getting you some recommendations of some avenues you might want to further investigate.
Kevin, I hope you will do that. Thanks very much for the call. I got to keep moving because I want to try to get as many as I can before we hit the top of the hour. Let's go now to Maryland. Levi in Maryland, watching on YouTube Live. You are next. Levi, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. I'm a Protestant who just recently started researching Catholicism, mm-hmm. and I have a question regarding Sola Scriptura.
Okay.
So for the sake of argument, let's say Sola Scriptura is false. Why would you say we should choose the Catholic Church over any other religious sect who does not hold to the doctrine of Sola Scriptura, mm-hmm. Like Mormons, Eastern mm-hmm. Orthodox, etc.?
Okay, well, so I would point you to Mormonism is kind of a separate thing because it has so many additional differences from the rest of people who call themselves Christian. In terms of the historic Christian sects, including Orthodoxy and others, I would say, and I'll have to be quick because we're getting near the end of the show and we got some more calls we're hoping to take, but especially line six, sorry.
Okay.
I gave a talk a number of years ago called Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals. And in that, one of the things and it's on my website, it's at jimmyakin.com. So if you Google Jimmy Akin, Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals, it will come up. Basically, I go through what Jesus says about his church and in Matthew 16 and Matthew 18. And from that, I derive the following facts, that his church is a visible entity with leaders and ordinary members. It has a structure. It has laws that can be broken. It has discipline that can be applied to lawbreakers, including excommunication. And it is founded in a special way it also will not pass out of existence. And it's founded in a special way on St. Peter. And so if we look around the world for a communion of Christians that has existed from the first century, because it wouldn't pass out of existence, so it's got to go all the way back, and that has this visible structure with laws and leaders and followers and is founded in a special way on St. Peter, that describes the Catholic Church in a way that it doesn't describe other bodies. There are also supporting arguments I would bring to bear on the question. A number of years ago, I wrote a short piece called Why I'm Not Eastern Orthodox that goes into some of the more specific reasons. But between those two pieces, Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals and Why I'm Not Eastern Orthodox, that would give you at least the core of how I would answer that question.
And Levi, I'm going to leave it there just because I got to get to everybody. So I hope that that's helpful to you, and I hope you will read those essays by Jimmy. Let's go to Mike in Arizona, listening on Catholic.com. Mike, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call real quick. I'll try to be quick because I know the show's ending. But my question to you is, I moved into this area just recently, and I moved into the area because of a girl that I'm hoping to marry.
Awesome.
And so essentially, in order to get to know her a little bit better, over the weekends, like sometimes on a Saturday or Sunday, I have stayed the night over at her house. I don't live with her. I've got my own place. Mm-hmm. I have slept in a different room, not mm-hmm. in the same room as her. And so my question to you is I read the article from Father Morrow that talked about cohabitating chastely, and I'm not cohabitating with her, to my understanding. But at the very end of the article, it talks about scandal. Mm-hmm. I'm calling because obviously I don't want to lead anybody into that. I don't feel that I'm deliberately by staying the night and staying in a different room there's no fornication, nothing like that going on. Does that fall in any way into the area of scandal?
Okay. Mike, I'm going to let Jimmy answer.
To cohabit means basically to live together under the same roof. And it is possible to cohabit chastely, and there are various reasons why people need to do that at times, even if they're of the opposite sex, like in the case of an invalidly married couple that stays together for the sake of their children, they may chastely cohabit. So chastely cohabiting is not intrinsically wrong. It is not a desirable situation. In your case, I'd say if you're over there on the weekends, you're chastely cohabiting for that time. Having said that, you're also putting yourself in the occasion of temptation, and that is not a good thing. And if people know about this, then that also could lead them to misunderstand the situation and think, oh, he's sleeping with that woman, and that's okay, in which case you would be giving scandal to other people. My advice, if you live in the same town, and I don't know, maybe you got to drive 20 minutes to get home, just drive the 20 minutes to get home and keep everything nice and clean. She'll respect you for it, recognizing that you're really wanting before marriage to do the right thing. And that sets you off on the right foot. If you do get married, she'll know you're a man who is committed to doing the right thing, even when it's personally a little inconvenient. And that's a great start for a marriage.
Mike, thanks very much. Appreciate the call. Thanks to everybody who called. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Tomorrow, a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops. And this one is questions from patrons. So that's always fun. Get to hear a great variety of questions. Jimmy, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Cy Kelly.
Love these 2-hour things.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.